Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast, looking ahead to the second half of April 2015 and produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis in our New York office.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Research Director. Welcome to the podcast. In this edition, Greece and Germany remain at odds over the latest move by Athens to negotiate maximally favorable terms in paying back its 2012 EU IMF bailout. An Iran nuclear deal appears closer, but significant hurdles remain, both at the negotiating table and in the U.S. Congress. But first, we'll look at the new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, whose founding irked Washington, but proved very popular in the rest of the world.
That's right, Chuck. The U.S. had tried very hard to prevent the new bank from gaining any traction. It's viewed in Washington by many as a kind of Chinese-sponsored rival to the IMF and World Bank, and there was some fear that its lending standards would undermine the fiscal discipline that these Washington-based institutions that grew out of World War II generally impose. But there's also a question of optics. In the second decade of the 21st century, it just struck too many people in power, including fairly internationalist President Obama, that this was a milestone in a kind of transition from the old American 20th century to one that might be defined by China. And so there was a lot of pressure from Washington on its allies, including Japan and the European Union, not to embrace this bank, to continue allowing this bank to gather traction slowly so that they could come to some agreement on what kind of lending terms would be on offer. But that just didn't work.
The U.S. may not have wanted this bank to gain traction, but it's gained quite a bit of traction. The floodgates, in fact, were opened in the first place by the U.K., which joined the infrastructure bank against the United States' warnings. Once that happened, a cascade of nations decided to sign up to this new international financial institution. And whether it was designed to act as a balance to the IMF or the World Bank or not, number one, it's going to be. And number two, it also shows that the opportunity to invest in Asian infrastructure projects is really hard to resist.
Yeah, and I think we even saw it this week. The World Bank president embraced the bank, which is an interesting development. I mean, there's a realization within the Obama White House this played fairly poorly. But to be fair to the president, the administration for years has been urging Congress to allow reform at the IMF and the World Bank that would give emerging market powers much greater say, and in fact bring more of their money into the bank to lend out. Congress has blocked that. It wasn't really Obama's fault completely, but certainly there's a lot of criticism of him right now for having misread this and made the United States look as though it was out of touch with the trends in the world.
Well, there are important trends in the world, and in fact, this is the second major international financial institution that China has sponsored and is driving. And, you know, the creation of the AIIB, the Infrastructure Bank, comes fairly quickly on the heels of the creation of the BRICS Bank, which is another international development bank being founded by the countries that make up the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And the bank is going to be based in China. So it looks like China is sort of putting its thumbs on the scales a bit in the financial services sector when it comes to large international organizations. You're absolutely right to point out that governance is going to be a massive question in the way this bank behaves and the kind of projects that it decides to support. I think we're just going to have to wait and see what kind of projects the bank gets behind and how transparent the lending process is. And now on to Iran. In late March, the Iran nuclear talks concluded with what is being called a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. In effect, a series of agreed parameters that are due to be finalized by June 30th. But the two key players, the U.S. and Iran, appear to differ on some of the provisions. And the U.S. Congress, not to mention Israel, still pose significant hurdles. Joining me to discuss the way forward is Henry Smith, a senior consultant in our Dubai office. Henry, tell me how you're receiving the news about the potential agreement with Iran. What are you thinking about the future of this deal, and does it make you optimistic?
I think it's difficult not to be optimistic about the next stages in this framework agreement. We have been surprised by the level of detail that has been provided in terms of what will and won't happen with Iran's nuclear enrichment program. However, the caution on that optimism really comes around the fact that you're seeing very competing interpretations of what has and hasn't been agreed coming out of Tehran and Washington, D.C. Most notably, some of the comments from Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, about the fact that they are expecting all sanctions to be released in one go, which is an entirely unrealistic expectation. However, I think we're now in a stage where really what's going on is optics around the agreement for domestic audiences in Tehran and the US primarily, but also elsewhere in the Middle East. And secondly, also people trying to set the framework and stage for the next round of talks where we will see more details over sanctions particularly.
Henry, I'm glad you pointed to the difference between the posturing for domestic and international consumption and the real concrete negotiating that remains to be done. Tell us, if you will, how much of the real work is left and how much more needs to be agreed before the agreement is final.
I think in broad terms, most of the nuclear-specific points which Iran will need to abide by seem to have been agreed. What is left is the phasing of when and how different sanctions from the US, EU, and the UN will be removed. What looks likely is that this agreement, when it happens, will be phrased as a UN Security Council resolution, which will amend or change the preceding six UN Security Council resolutions on Iran, and therefore make it internationally binding and protect it from potential risks within the US and Iran. But in terms of how businesses are thinking about this, what is clear that thus far, nothing has changed in terms of the economic and business limitations and what can and can't be done with Iran.
Henry, it sounds like we're pretty close to what could be a landmark deal. How excited should the business community be at this point?
The conversations we have with clients about Iran are uniformly positive about Iran being a potentially rewarding market for them. You know, you just look at the economic fundamentals, the demographics of the place, and you know, no one's in any doubt that this is a place where companies could potentially make a lot of money. But some of the issues around sanctions, particularly, and other forms of market and partner risk, remain pronounced. So the excitement is clearly there. The opportunity is clearly there. If this deal happens, then of course people will be lining up to try and make the most out of it. But people need to tread with caution. One of the interesting things that we anticipate happening, and we don't really get a lot of coverage of at the moment in the international media, is how different political forces and business forces in Iran and elsewhere in the Gulf will react to this deal and how they will try and position themselves around it, both politically and in terms of securing their own financial stakes in this agreement.
Henry Smith from our Dubai office, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chuck. The Eurozone crisis, of late at least, could fairly be encapsulated with one word: Greece. The new leftist government in Athens has just made a payment on its 2012 bailout, but has also advanced a new and startling demand that Germany, the EU's biggest economy, pay it some $300 billion, that's about 278 billion euros, in reparations for its occupation of the country during World War II. Joining me now to discuss this latest twist is Control Risk Senior Analyst for Europe, David Lee. David, what does this new demand do to fragile debt negotiations?
A claim of this extent on Germany, I don't think that's going to be taken particularly seriously in Germany, and I don't think it's going to be particularly helpful for the atmosphere of hardworking, friendly, yet sensible negotiations that have to take place in the coming few weeks. Largely, it's going to be set to one side and work will continue as if it hadn't happened. But there is clearly a feeling in Greece that that shouldn't be the case.
Does it appear that Greece is trying to find alternate ways out of this, or do you think the government is going to ultimately stick with the debt repayment plan?
Greece has been quite clear in the last couple of days that it sees its problem as a Greek problem and as a European problem and isn't really searching for a non-European solution to it. Tsipras himself said as much on his way out of Moscow, the finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, said the same. So I don't think they're going in search of money from Russia. I also don't think Russia's in a particularly strong position to give them any.
Where are we going next now? What's the next trigger, and what does it mean for businesses that are heavily invested in Europe?
The next date to watch really is the 24th of April, when there's a meeting of the Eurogroup, the collection of Eurozone finance ministers, which effectively sets the political direction, if not necessarily the economic direction of the Euro. That's run by the European Central Bank. And I think there's going to have to be some serious steps forward coming out of that meeting. So they're going to have to either approve Greece's direction and possibly release a new tranche of funds, or they're going to have to reject it and, you know, put us in a real crisis phase here. There are a number of further repayments coming up fairly steadily over the course of the summer. Each one of those could be made or missed. It's literally that tense a situation, really.
All right. Well, David Lee in London, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Well, a few other notable events in the coming fortnight. On Monday, 13 April, presidential and parliamentary polls open in Sudan, where the opposition plans to boycott. Our analysts are concerned about the risks of increased unrest during the 3 days of voting. Tuesday, 14 April, brings Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to Washington, D.C. to speak with President Obama and others. The following day, Wednesday, 15 April, the West African state of Togo holds its presidential elections. Our West Africa team sees incumbent President Faure Gnassingbé winning by a wide margin.
That's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political, integrity, and security risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. Also on our website, you can view an in-depth look at prospects for Iran as the debate over its nuclear accord continues. From my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Charles Hecker in London, saying so long for now.
And from New York, I'm Michael Moran. Until next time, goodbye.